This is Illinois Edition. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Today we're joined by a name you may know, Kelly McEvers. Covered the Middle East for NPR. She's a native of the region from the Lincoln area, and now her folks live out in Petersburg, and she's back for a visit. Good to see you once again.
Thanks for having me in.
And a lot of listeners have heard your voice a lot over the last few years. As you covered the Middle East, you've covered it in some form or fashion for the last 7 years nearly, and now you're stepping down or moving job, so to speak, and coming back to the States, and you're going to be based in L.A. as a correspondent for NPR out there. Can you give us a little preview of what we're going to see there?
Well, I'm going to be a national correspondent based in Los Angeles, and I am open to ideas. I have a little time to figure out what I'm going to cover, what my beat's going to be. I'm going to experiment with a few things here and there. Crime and punishment is obviously kind of an interest of mine, so that might be a region of that might be, you know, the area that I pursue. But yeah, Twitter, Facebook, send me ideas. I'd love to hear people's suggestions of how I should cover America.
Well, you've certainly been on a challenging beat where you've been. You came back with producing a lot of stories. You even had a documentary earlier this year. We'll get to talking about Syria in particular in a moment. But as you kind of look back on your time in the Middle East, what are a couple of the lasting impressions you have from all the time you spent over there?
Oh, gosh. You know,
I know that's a harder question than it sounds.
You know, we hear a lot about America's waning influence in the Middle East. And I think it's a really important thing to think about as we, especially now, as we look to whether or not America should become involved in Syria. You know, 10 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan has left, understandably, our country pretty wary, I guess, of involvement in the Middle East. And I think there's a reason that a lot of people here think maybe it's time to let that region be to itself and handle its own problems and resolve its own problems. But I think it's important to remember, too, as somebody who lived there for so long, that there are still really important national security issues that are important to us every single day. We may not be able to see them. We may not be able to touch them or feel them. But there are things that are super important and would affect us should we just let them to their own devices. I'm not arguing for intervention. I'm not saying, you know, we should be deeply involved in other people's affairs. But I am saying that, you know, it's important to know that when you're talking about things like chemical weapons or organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah, you know, left to their own devices, those organizations and those types of weapons could come to hurt us.
And as you spend that time there, and you see that Syria is dominating the discussion these past few weeks, what is it that a news consumer should kind of keep an eye on in this discussion?
And the discussion about Syria, you know, there's so many things, you know, when you have to step back and think about the big picture. And it's nice. I've had a little time off to do that. One thing I think we're thinking so much about Iraq, and we should think about Iraq, and we should be really skeptical anytime our government considers whether or not to get involved militarily in a country. But with Iraq, it was, you know, there was an invasion based on the suspicion that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. We not only know that Syria and President Bashar al-Assad has weapons, chemical weapons, he's used them. You know, he has used them and he has killed people with them. And so I think that's a pretty important distinction to make. If you just want to step back and say, okay, what are the key differences here? One was a suspicion and one was we know that he's used them and we know that he's willing to kill his own people by the thousands. You know, before he used chemical weapons, he was using Scud missiles on his own people, dropping bombs on people while they waited for bread. I mean, I saw that with my own eyes, right? Airstrikes on children. This is a guy who's not a nice guy. You know, I'm not arguing for intervention, but I am saying this is a guy who plays hardball. And maybe the only way he's going to respond is if we play hardball too.
There are 2 million refugees. And you always tried to cover the situation and the stories of the refugees. How do refugees fare when this kind of action will be possibly taking place?
We've got some reports out of my old bureau, Beirut, Lebanon, where some of the aid agencies are setting up centers because they know once any kind of military action takes place, there will be more refugees. More people will stream out of Syria by the thousands, possibly by the tens of thousands, as the military activity increases. That's not a good thing. The countries surrounding Syria are already totally strapped. There is not enough. There are not enough resources for these people. People are living rough. They are living outside. You know, I've seen people living in cardboard boxes, you know, begging for a piece of tarp, you know, inside Syria. There are even millions more people who are just displaced from their homes. We spent a night in a school in a first grade classroom with a huge extended family that had basically set up shop there. And there's no sense that that situation is going to change anytime soon.
When you're over there and say you're sneaking across the border or something, it's not the same as sneaking into the Menard County Fair, which I'm sure you've done. But do you have people with you? Do you have a translator? Are you doing this alone? What is – set the picture a little bit for those kinds of situations.
We always work in a team. There are a few reporters out there who actually like to work alone, people who are native to the region, so speak the language fluently. I speak some Arabic, but for me, I think it makes sense to always be with a Syrian if I'm in Syria, for one. Somebody who not only can translate the language but can just sort of translate – the culture, you know, the gestures, maybe some kind of, you know, face someone makes or the way someone's moving. Not only that, it's someone who, you know, is also a journalist, a Syrian journalist. I worked a lot with a colleague named Rima Marouche, who's fantastically talented and smart. And, you know, when you've got two heads in one situation, it's always probably better than one, sort of sussing out, well, is this a story? Is this person telling us the truth? Are we being led down the wrong road? In addition, you know, we always have, you know, someone called a fixer, that's somebody who knows that particular local area, you know, that village, that road, that town. And then we also work with someone who's called a security advisor. This is like a former, usually a former British Special Forces soldier who comes with us as a trained medic, as someone who understands weaponry. You know, I'm focused on getting the story, and this person might be focused on, oh, are those mortars incoming or outgoing, which is a pretty important distinction that you need to make when you're in a situation like that.
So does somebody that you're with have weapons?
No, absolutely not. No, we do not go with armed security advisors. No, they're there not to fight. We are non-combatants, and we have to always distinguish ourselves as non-combatants. Once you bring a weapon into a situation like that, you are a completely different player in the game, right? And journalists, we have to maintain that we are, you know, separate from this fight somehow, even though we might be embedded with one side or the other. You know, we have to be able to say, look, we stand back and we just tell the story. So no, weapons are definitely not something we do.
You have a four-year-old daughter, and your husband travels back and forth. When you were over there, he would be with you some of the time. What's it like for a family life when you cover the Middle East?
I mean, generally speaking, it's pretty normal. Like on a Tuesday night, I'm cooking dinner, putting my daughter to bed, getting up the next morning and walking her to her wonderful little school that's like four blocks from our house in Beirut, Lebanon, which is by and large a fairly, you know, normal city to live in. The violence from Syria has been spilling over into Lebanon. So we have seen some targeted assassinations, some violence along the borders, you know, some kind of spillover of the sectarian fighting that we see in Syria kind of heading into Lebanon. But that didn't really affect our neighborhoods. It didn't affect our schools. It didn't affect our way of life. So, you know, when I was in town, it was pretty much like anybody else's Tuesday night, you know, to be a family in the Middle East. But when I was on the road and traveling in and out of Syria, it's obviously really, you know, stressful time. I mean, everybody's worried about when I'm going to come home and, frankly, whether I'm going to come home. We lost more journalists in 2012 than ever before, at least since we've been keeping records. It was a terrible year. Some of the best reporters in the business, Anthony Shadid of the New York Times, Marie Colvin of the Times of London, both died in Syria while reporting. You know, that is – you can't escape that. You can't just pretend that that's not true every time you go off on a reporting trip. You think about it and it weighs on you, and eventually, you know, not everybody makes the decision to leave, and I don't think everybody should make the decision to leave. I just realized that I'd done my time. I'd covered Syria for 2 years, and now it's time for somebody else to do it.
And we look forward to hearing your next adventures and what you cover as a national correspondent based in California.
Thanks.